our third case today in the matter of the disciplinary proceedings against Nicholas C. Graxis. The Board of Attorney's Professional Responsibility versus the respondent. Counsel?
Good afternoon. My name is Nick Graxis, and I have brought this appeal because I think it presents some significant issues concerning the practice of immigration law. One of the issues presented is, when does an attorney represent a client for immigration purposes? The regulations of immigration service are pretty clear that a client must sign what's called Form G-28, entitled Notice of Appearance as Attorney. And I think the reasoning behind that is very good. It avoids any problems of when does an attorney represent a client and who does an attorney represent. Form G-28 specifies what client is represented and for what purpose. In this case before us, I was representing Miriam Nassidi as an employee and the school as her employer for purposes of obtaining an extension of her H-1B visa status. The I-129 petition that starts the proceeding for the H-1B visa status is an employer's petition signed only by the employer. It is the employer that goes through these proceedings to obtain the approval for the employee. The approval must be obtained by the Department of Labor for the prevailing wage and by immigration for the actual H-1B status. This was done in the instant case. Now, in order to do that, the client and the employee, who are both, in this case, both clients, must contribute information in order for an attorney to complete the petition. The questions asked in the petition are concerning information only in the possession of the employer and in the possession of the employee. The attorney himself would not have the knowledge to answer those questions unless that petition was reviewed and the information given to the attorney. And that is what happened in this case. I obtained the information about the school, for example, when it was established, how many employees does the school have, what is the gross annual income for the school. I obtained information from the employee, whether she had a passport, what her current address is, a copy of her I-94 card to obtain the information as to what is her current H-1B status and when does it expire. I obtained information as to answer the question whether she was in any deportation proceedings and also whether
she wanted... How do you find out? Did you ask her?
Yes. I asked her and also had her review of the petition itself.
What do you mean, review of the petition itself?
I presented the petition to her and told her to let me know how some of these questions should be answered.
Well, that sounds to me as if it would take a couple hours in your office.
Not only my office, I also sent it to her and to her employer.
I know. Did you have to go check her out in the various records to make sure that she wasn't telling you the truth? I'm trying to figure out what kind of timeline we're talking about and how long this would all take.
This would take several days because the employer was out of state. I would have to send the...
And what time was this being done, sir?
At what time?
Yeah, I mean, what day of the month, what year?
This was done in 95.
Okay.
I don't remember the exact date of the month. I'd have to look
that
up. And it was done prior to the H-1B status of Ms. Nassidi expiring. We had to do it prior to that in order to allow enough time to obtain the approval of the Department of Labor and Immigration. To get some of the information from Ms. Nassidi, I had to ask for a copy of her passport, a copy of her I-94 card. The significance of that is the H-1B visa is entered on a page in the passport, and the status of her visa while she's in the United States is entered on the I-94 card. Another question asked in that petition, for the employee's part, is are you filing any application for any of your dependents? And her answer to me was no. She said any problems she had with her daughters, two of which were U.S. citizens, one of which was not. She would handle herself, and if she had any problems, she would let me know, and then I could enter in and represent her daughters.
Counsel, in your brief on pages 11 and 12, you have excerpts from the transcript of her testimony at the hearing.
Yes.
And in that transcript, the question and answers indicate that you, based on the information I'm sure that she gave you, or supplied to you, you filled out the application, and then she came in and you asked her to review it and to sign it.
I filled out the final version. There's a draft version before we get to the final version.
And her response in that testimony was, with regard to her child, I didn't even know that I was supposed to file an application for any dependents that I have. That's why you were completing the application and I was not. When you were asking her about that, no, that's what her response was. Can you explain that?
Yes, I understand what her response was, but it was different from what I had a conference with her about. The written documentation shows that I was representing her in the school. If I were also asked to represent her daughter, I would have another notice of appearance form to enter the name of her daughter and sign it, acknowledging I'm representing her daughter.
What was the finding that the referee made with regard to that credibility determination?
I don't believe there's a specific finding as to her credibility.
I mean, as to what actually happened with regard to the request for application for the child.
I don't recall the examiner's exact finding on that issue. I don't think that was specifically addressed.
Why don't you look at Appendix 103 in the board's brief? Bottom three, as a finding of fact, the referee said that Ms. Nasidi also told you that she had three minor children. Her eldest child was born in Nigeria, and that Nasidi had been admitted entry into the U.S. on an H-4 dependent status, and that N. Nasidi, which is, I gather, the child, is an alien born in Nigeria and was required to obtain its lawful visa status. See, finding 27 also is that when the mother applied for the extension in May, that she did not know she would have to file an application to extend her daughter's immigration status. The finding on number 28, is that she expected you to advise her whether an application was needed to extend it. And that 29, that you made no inquiry as to whether she knew the procedure necessary to keep her dependent daughter in status for immigration purposes. Do you contest those findings?
Yes, Your Honor, I do. That was the testimony, the effect of the testimony of Ms. Nasidi at that time, but that was not what transpired between her and I at the time of the conferences in my office. And the reason I point to the written documentation and its significance is that in order to avoid problems like this, the immigration regulations and the case law specify clients must have an G-28 file to notify immigration who the attorney is representing. If I were representing any one of her daughters, there would be a G-28 on file. I have no problem with doing that. But my understanding at the time we had our conference with Ms. Nasidi in my office, I would not be representing any of her daughters because she would take care of any problems, and if she couldn't take care of them, then she would notify me, and then I would represent her. And this is what happened later, 2 years later, in 97, with her daughter that was an alien born. And then she notified me that they forgot to apply for the extension of the daughter's H-4 visa. And at that time, I had him execute a G-28 for the daughter. I filed a petition to extend, and immigration in their discretion under that, those circumstances denying the extension.
In all of this, did you do anything wrong?
Did I do anything wrong? I followed the regular procedure on how to comply with the H-1B petition. I asked the client for her passport, I asked for the I-94 card, I asked her to go through the questions for not only the employer but for the employee, so I know how to answer the questions. Otherwise, I would not know. No attorney would know that.
I mean, in the filing of it and keeping her advised properly and all of the allegations that the board has made, did you do anything improper?
Well, when I got the decision on the H-4 extension application, I think that I didn't notify her until about 3 or 4 days later. And that the board thought was not promptly. But it was within a reasonable time. I didn't notify her the same day I got it. But it was in about 3 or 4 days later. I did fax her a copy.
Well, look, you apparently got most of the information by the fall of 95. Is that right?
For the H-1B, yes.
She had come to see you in October of 94.
We started the process then for the labor certification.
And when did you file?
For which process? The
any process.
Any process? The H-1B was filed prior to the expiration time in 95. The labor certification, there was specific problems peculiar to that, in that at that time, in 94, 95, there were governmental problems of shutdowns that caused enormous backlogs in among the various federal agencies, especially the Department of Labor. And one of the problems immigration attorneys had is how to approach this backlog, this inordinate growing of the backlog for new cases that had to be filed. And why that is significant is that many aliens do not have enough visa time to last, to have that backlog processed by the Department of Labor and Immigration. And that was the case in Ms. Nassidi's case, because I told her from the beginning that when she came to me in 95, that she would not have, it appeared to me, she would not have enough time to complete it before her H-1B visa expired. That it would require at least 2 years to clear the Department of Labor and Immigration. Now, he had two other cases also filed approximately the same time, and they did not clear even the Department of Labor in time before the visas expired for those clients. So there was some argument at the hearing by the expert witness as to the strategy used. But no matter which strategy was used, I mean, whether you followed the regular procedure or whether you did what I did, trying to monitor the various developments that were occurring as to how to overcome this backlog problem for clients who do not have enough visa time.
Did you tell her all of this?
I didn't. In the beginning, I did explain to her that she would probably not have enough time to do it. But step by step, as we were going through it, I did not properly inform her.
And so you didn't tell her you hadn't filed?
I told her I was checking the situation. I didn't tell her that I had not filed, and I didn't tell her that I did file, but I was checking the situation, and my strategy was to determine what to be done, because there were various approaches as to how to overcome this backlog problem. One was to ask the Department of Labor, would they make any exceptions? And finally, a ruling came out, I think it was in October of 96, by one of the alien immigration attorneys, that no exceptions would be made, not even if the alien was in deportation proceedings. So the Department of Labor would just allow this backlog to remain and new cases pile up behind it. And as a result, no matter what way you approached the case in Ms. Nassidi's circumstances, she would not have finished before her visa would have expired.
You didn't file it with the labor, with the Indiana agency until February 97?
That's correct.
Do you admit that you altered the dates on that document?
I admit I did change the dates because that's part of the procedure that I follow. If I if an original document has a certain date, by the time of filing, it becomes late, or it shows like a late document, I update the document by updating the date, and that's what I did in this case.
Well, maybe something had changed between the time you got all this information and the update. Did you check that?
Yes. I mean, there was nothing changed between the school and Mrs. Nassidi. The only thing I changed was the date of the document to show that it was not an old document, but a fairly recent document. That was my purpose for doing that.
Isn't that date, counsel, supposed to reflect the date upon which it was executed by Ms. Nassidi?
Well, executed by Ms. Nassidi. Well, Ms. Nassidi didn't execute that document. She executed part of it. Part of it was by the employer, part of it by her.
Right, but the date is supposed to be associated with her signature, verifying that what's in it is true, right?
That's true.
And so you altered the document.
I altered the date of the document pursuant to what immigration considers an attorney having full authority to act on behalf of the client. And all the actions I did in this case, like any other case, were on behalf of the client.
It's your position that immigration would have approved you altering a date upon which a client actually executed an official governmental document?
Yes.
Is that pursuant to immigration policy?
Pursuant to the law of immigration that says an attorney has full authority to act on behalf of a client, including admissions or concessions.
Including falsifying a document, basically.
No, not falsifying, just updating a document.
But you didn't update anything other than to change the date.
Yeah, that is exactly what I updated, just the date.
But that falsified the document because it purported to represent to the agency that it was executed on that date, which in fact it was not.
It was an updated document. That's all my purpose was.
Did you update anything else in the document?
No, I did not.
All right. Did you attempt to verify with anybody whether the information in it was still true?
Well, I had no other reason to change anything. I had no, in my conferences with the client, there was no changes.
Did you ask
the information?
Did you say to her, I'm going to update this, I'm changing the date, I want to make sure nothing's changed?
I knew from my conferences with her that nothing had changed, not her address, nothing, not her credentials, not her job description.
How did you know that?
When we were talking with each other.
Well, it sounds like these conversations were very cursory, if they occurred at all. And there is evidence in the record that many of the phone calls from her to you were not, in fact, returned. And those that were constituted essentially you avoiding engaging her in any conversation whatsoever and trying to slough it off and tell her you would check into it. That's what the record bears.
We had prior to the time she used to call me, we had many conversations about the details of the information in the application. Nothing from that time was changing.
Mr. Grapsis,
yeah.
When you were monitoring this backlog that you were telling us about, how were you monitoring it? What were you doing?
One of the organizations I'm a member of is the American Immigration Lawyers Association, and one of the things they maintain is called the InfoNet, which is a website. And on this website, publishes these various memos and notices from the various government agencies involved with immigration, Department of Labor, and the Nebraska Service Center, the Central Office of Immigration in Washington, as to these problems, and also the responses or remedies that various attorneys were doing throughout the country as to how to cope with these problems. And the attorneys themselves would publish memos and notices as to what action they were taking. Some were putting out surveys on this website to accumulate information about all these problems with the understanding they may start a class action and even to start an action for mandamus to compel the Department of Labor to perform what they're supposed to perform under the statute. And so these are the kind of circumstances I was monitoring and where I was getting the information, and also from the ELA monthly magazine and from another professional magazine called Interpreter Releases. It's a weekly publication that puts out various case rulings and notices from the various departments of the government as to the progress or lack of progress in various problem areas of immigration.
Was it your understanding that other attorneys facing the same kind of problem for his or her client would take the same kind of action, delay filing?
That was my understanding for some of them, because the problem was, even if you followed the regular procedure and filed when everything was ready, it would not help overcoming how to get through the backlog. The problem was, how can you get an application, take an application, and run it through the backlog? And it turned out there was no way. The Department of Labor would not make any exceptions. And there was no way to do it. So whether you followed the regular procedure of filing when it was ready, or monitoring the situation and deciding when to file it, for those clients that didn't have enough visa time, like Ms. Nassidi, the process could not be completed, either with the Department of Labor or with immigration, before the time it ran out for her.
Were you explaining these things to your client?
I'm afraid I did not adequately explain that part of the problem with her. But even though I may have been lax in communicating this with her, this did not deprive her of, when her time ran out, like with other clients that ran out, visa time ran out, from adjusting her status. Congress had recognized these problems and passed two sections of the Immigration Nationality Act to cope with this. One was Section 245I, and the other was Section 245K. And both of those sections provide ways of clients who did not have enough visa time for whatever the reason, and even if they were illegal, to still have their status adjusted to obtain the green card.
I just want to switch to another subject, but basically dealing with this lack of communication and no response with the board itself, the BAPA board. I understand the complaint is now brought in 1997, and you've had some prior, I believe you've been reprimanded once or twice before, and you've had communication with the board, and I just noticed. What is your response to, according to the, on page 26 of the Board of Professional Responsibility brief, it talks about your failure to cooperate with them, and they sent you a letter, this is in July of 97, and then they sent you a certified letter a month later, and what they say is, again, no response. And is there some reason why you did not respond to the board when apparently they had a complaint from your client? They wanted to get a hold of you and find out not only what was happening to get a hold of you. Was there some reason you did not or did not respond to those?
Well, it's not that I did not respond. I did not respond within the designated time when those letters were sent. Well, however, I did respond in full, in writing. I did cooperate with the investigators. I did attend the interview and the hearing.
Well, the SRC rule says you should respond within 20 days of being served by ordinary mail. And if I'm correct, and I'm just reading from this, July, no response, then a certified letter in August of 97, no response. When did you respond to those, if you did respond, sir?
I did respond to those. I don't have the exact dates before me, but I did respond in writing with my own letter explaining the problems,
but
not within the designated time originally sent.
Well, did you respond 2 months later or three?
No, I think it was probably a month later, within a few weeks.
A few weeks of the certified letter?
Of the certified letter, I believe,
which was the August 14th, 1997 letter you responded.
Yes, I recall responding. I don't recall exact dates, but I did respond in all cases. And it did not ignore the board in the sense of not responding or not cooperating at all.
You had been disciplined prior to that twice for some of the same conduct. What did it take for you to understand that this was serious? Because here it is again, the third time, and again you failed to respond.
Well, I was not disciplined just for that. I think the prior two cases involved other issues besides a delayed response to the letters. The first case involved the issue of what, you know, since Immigration Milwaukee could not find their file, the hearing examiner concluded that I did not do the work. The second case involved a difference in interpretation of law, where in some circuits, like the Ninth Circuit says, an alien that was on F-1 practical training, and if that practical training expired but before the expiration date, the employer applied for the H-1B visa, the employee could still continue to work.
But at least according to the brief from the Dapper, in both of those investigations, Graps has failed to respond to the board's initial letters requesting that he supply information in response to clients' grievances.
I only failed to respond within the designated time. I did respond in each of those cases with my letters. Okay. But I do admit it was a late response to their letters. But I did not fail to respond. I did respond in delay.
So if all of this was a matter of legitimate immigration law strategy, why wouldn't you respond right away?
Well, I agree that I didn't do as best as I could in that respect in responding. But one of my problems here is that I think these issues in the immigration field of practice, the proper form in order to get any advancement or any advance in the immigration law, the remedy should be before the immigration offices of the administrative appeals and federal courts, because the BOPR bar, for example, is not going to be able to change anything having to do with immigration, whether we're talking about due process or anything else, or perfecting any remedy. So I was getting irritated that the clients, instead of coming to me and saying, what can we do about these problems with immigration, were instead filing with the bar a complaint as if, you know, I was doing something wrong in each case all the time.
But wouldn't it seem, going back to this lack of response, forgetting about the claim, the immigration difficulty we're having, the not responding to a BAPR or the Board of Professional Responsibility request, and then saying to us now that you don't recall when you responded, but you know that you did respond, and Justice Babbitt saying, well, you have been disciplined twice before, and similar type lack of cooperation, according to the brief, it confounds me to understand why you wouldn't respond, understanding that that would pique their curiosity. If you had this concern about what was happening, you could have explained it to them.
I understand, and I apologize for not having responded with the time limit set. But all I want to bring to your attention is I did respond, even though it was a delayed response. I did not ignore the board by not responding at all.
Thank you.
I see my light. Oh, I'm sorry.
Yes, thank you, and you have 5 minutes in rebuttal,
okay,
sir. Mr. Schwarzenberg.
Thank you, Your Honor. Justices of this court, I'm Paul Schwarzenbart of Madison, Wisconsin. I represent the Board of Attorneys' Professional Responsibility in this matter.
Mr. Schwarzenbart, if that podium is too low, you may raise it. At your left hand, at the top of the podium. No, put your hand on the top of the podium. There you go.
I'm technologically challenged, Your Honor. I'm honored to appear before the court today as one of the board's private counsel in this matter. Your Honors, attorney discipline cases are important cases both to the public and to this court because effective self-regulation of lawyers and the legal practice is essential if our society is to maintain faith in attorneys and the legal process in general. I think practicing law is both a privilege and a responsibility. Consistent with the objectives of self-regulation, I believe that there are two major themes which emerge from the Attorney's Code of Professional Responsibility. One of those themes is competence. The other one is that in practicing law, attorneys do so with personal and professional integrity. I believe, unfortunately, the record in this case shows that both of those were seriously compromised by Mr. Graps' conduct, which gave rise to these proceedings. A few brief comments, Your Honors, on the context of this matter. I think Your Honors are aware of it generally by the questions which were addressed to Mr. Graps', but a couple of points. First of all, who is the client? Who is Miriam Nassidi? She is a lady from Nigeria. She's in her mid-40s. She's a teacher of French language and literature at high school level in Indiana. She sought out Mr. Grapps' services to assist her in obtaining what's known as a green card, which is an authorization for her to remain and work in the United States as a permanent resident alien. At that point in time, she was working for an employer in Indiana. She obtained Mr. Grapps' services on the basis of a recommendation of a friend who she knew from her days as a student here in Madison. Mr. Grapps has been licensed since 1970. Since the late 1970s, he's devoted a substantial portion of his practice to immigration law. It's undisputed that he holds himself out to the public as having special expertise in this area. He's a member of the AILA, as he indicated, which is the professional association. He has, unfortunately, on two occasions been previously disciplined, and I believe it's important that on both of those occasions, those were engagements involving immigration law.
And you are counsel for the board in at least one of them.
In the second of those two, Your Honor. This case comes before the court on Mr. Grapps' appeal from the report and recommendation of the referee in this case. And pursuant to this court's standards of review in attorney discipline cases, the court will defer to the findings of fact of the referee unless they are clearly erroneous. On the other hand, the court does independently review the findings of fact, the conclusions of law and the recommended discipline. With that by way of background, I want to turn to what I believe are the issues in this case which Mr. Grapps has raised on his appeal. The referee's report was adverse to Mr. Grapps on each of the 8 claims of discipline. It appears that in his brief, Mr. Grapps has conceded 2 of the claims, which are claims 2 and 3, the failure to communicate claims. So I won't spend a great deal of time addressing those. I'm first going to address the first claim, which is under Supreme Court Rule 20:1.3 sub A, the allegation that Mr. Grapps failed to represent Miriam Nassidi by acting with diligence and promptness in that he failed to initiate the green card application process in a timely fashion. Now, I think for the court to understand the parameters of Mr. Grapps' duty with respect to that application, it's important to understand the 4 parts that go into the application process, and there's no dispute about what those 4 parts are. The application process is initiated by filing what's called a labor certification application with the state agency, which was in this case the Indiana Department of Workforce Development. That application, once it's approved by the state agency, then goes to the Federal Department of Labor for review. Those are the first 2 steps in the process. The 3rd step is where the Immigration and Naturalization Service comes in. Step 3 is called a petition for alien worker, involves the filing of an I-140 form, and the last step is the actual petition to adjust status, which is consummated with the filing of what's called an I-485 form. That's also with the Immigration and Naturalization Service. Now, what the gist of the board's complaint, and as the referee found, was neglect, was that Mr. Grapps was engaged by Ms. Nassidi in the fall of 1994 to begin this green card application process. There was a period of time in which some information had to be gathered by Mr. Grapps in order to complete the form, the labor certification application, which is also referred to as the ETA 750, and I believe in our brief we also call it the employment application. There was a period of information gathering. During that time, Mr. Grapps completed what's called an H-1B extension application for Ms. Nassidi. Ms. Nassidi had been admitted to the United States following the completion of her education in H-1B status, which is a professional employment status, in which aliens can remain in the United States as long as they're employed in a specific category for up to 6 years, at which time they would have to normally depart from the country for at least 1 year, unless at that point in time they've obtained permanent resident status. So Mr. Grapsis did file the H-1B application in May of 1995, and once that was done, Ms. Nassidi's six-year eligibility would take her up through August of 1997. So in order for her to remain lawfully employed in the United States, it was essential that she complete the green card application process by August of 1997. Now she, according to the testimony in the record, I believe as the referee found, by July of 1995, she had supplied the information to Mr. Grapsis that he needed to complete step one in the application process, which was the LCA. In November of 1995, he sent the form to Ms. Nassidi to have it signed by her and by her employer, and they did so, I believe, on November 14 of 1995. The testimony was undisputed, and it was found by the referee that she promptly returned those forms to Mr. Grapsis, expecting that he would then initiate the green card application process by filing the LCA with Indiana upon receipt. Of course, that didn't happen in November of 1995. We know now that Mr. Grapsis didn't file the LCA until February 24th of 1997. And the issue that the referee looked at and that Mr. Grapsis is raising here today was that failure neglect, or was this a legitimate strategic decision which he made as an immigration lawyer that his client would not be able to complete the process on time, so she would be better off not filing her application and waiting for some type of special relief from the government. The referee is the trier of fact in this case. The referee heard the expert testimony of Mr. Sullivan, who was retained by the board precisely because we concede knowledge of immigration law was crucial to educate the referee and for this court to assess Mr. Grapsis' conduct. The referee heard the testimony. She heard the testimony from Mr. Sullivan, who testified that 98% of his practice is devoted to employment-related immigration matters. He's been a practitioner in the field for 10 years. Mr. Sullivan's testimony in substance was he had no knowledge whatsoever of any reason why you would delay the filing of a labor application with Indiana.
Did you check the sources that Mr. Grapsis referred to?
Those sources, Your Honor, are in the record. The board prepared a set of trial exhibits, which I believe are in the record. They're in a red-bound folder. And the exhibits in this file, starting with Exhibit 12 through Exhibit 29, are various items offered by Mr. Grapsis in support of this thesis that there was some sort of strategic opportunity to get an advantageous position in the queue, so to speak. Maybe it's my ignorance in immigration law, Your Honor, but I read those materials, and there was nothing in those materials that suggested that there was ever any prospect for some type of special relief program to clear up the backlog that Mr. Grapsis referred to. That's what the referee found when she reviewed this material. That was Mr. Sullivan's testimony. So that has been examined. I think that the referee's findings on this strategic defense are summarized in paragraphs 38, 39, and 40 of the referee's findings of fact, where the referee noted at paragraph 38 that the record reflects it was taking about 200 days as of December 1995 to complete the first two stages of this application process. That's what an immigration lawyer like Mr. Grapsis would have known back in November or December of 1995. Mr. Sullivan's point on the 200 days was simply this. He candidly admitted he couldn't testify to a reasonable degree of professional certainty whether or not the timely commencement of this proceeding would have allowed the process to be completed on time. But what his testimony was that there was nothing to be gained by delaying the filing, and a reasonable practitioner could have believed in November of 1995 that the process would be timely completed. And I think that's borne out by Mr. Grapsis's own conduct, because he's alluded to two other filings that he made on behalf of Wisconsin clients at about the same time. If Mr. Grapsis's strategy in November of 1995 was not to file so that these applications wouldn't get caught in a backlog, why did he file the two applications on behalf of Wisconsin clients but not file it for Ms. Nassidi? It simply doesn't make any sense. At paragraph 39, the referee notes that Mr. Grapsis supplied no information indicating there were any proposals before INS or DOL during 1995 or 1996 to change the processing of ETA 750 applications by giving priority to applicants who had not filed or by creating a separate track for those who had not filed. The referee goes on in paragraph 40 to state that other justification for lack of action related to the general federal government shutdown and actions Ms. Nassidi should have taken are wholly illogical and unsupported by any facts. It defies common sense to suggest that you get ahead in the line by not getting in line in the first place. And I point out one of the exhibits in the record, Your Honor, when this application was eventually filed, there was a response from Indiana, and this is Exhibit 6. Page 2 of Exhibit 6 from the Indiana Department of Workforce Development notes, these cases will be put in the queue and will be reviewed in the order they are received. That's what common sense tells you happens when you're filing applications for government action. In substance, Your Honor, we believe the record supports the referee's findings of fact on the neglect issue fully and completely. There is nothing in the record to support this defense that Mr. Grapsis has offered, that there was some sort of strategic reason not to timely file the LCA. And because those findings are not clearly erroneous, the board submits that they should be affirmed by this court. I want to turn now to claim number 4, which involves Mr. Grapsis's attack on the findings and conclusions regarding the finding of the referee that he violated Supreme Court Rule 20:1.4 sub B by failing to explain matters to Ms. Nassidi sufficiently concerning her daughter's immigration status. I think it's evident from Mr. Grapsis's argument before the court today that he still doesn't grasp what the gist of this claim involves. The gist of this claim has nothing to do with signing a G-28 form. A G-28 form is simply a standard form notice of appearance that's filed in an immigration matter. The G-28 form is not the starting point of the attorney's duty. The attorney's duty begins when the attorney-client relationship begins. In a litigation matter, an attorney's duty to the client doesn't begin when you file a notice of appearance with the court. The notice of appearance and the G-28 form itself simply says, this is the client's signed authorization to tell the agency that Mr. Grapsis is authorized to represent me as my attorney in immigration matters.
Well, he's saying, counsel, that no such form was signed for the child, that he never thought he was representing the child, that indeed the mother said, don't represent the child, or words to that effect. And that the failure of him, his filing a form he knows should be filed, shows he was never a meeting of the minds on that.
Well, I think it's fair to say that the referee's findings of fact on that point are inconsistent with Mr. Grapsis's testimony, and the testimony on that issue was indeed disputed. It's the board's position relative to that claim concerning the daughter that Mr. Grapsis's duty to his client was to explain the situation to her to make sure that she understood what needed to be done relative to her daughter's immigration status, because as she testified, she didn't know she needed to file a separate form for her daughter. So she was not in a position to make an informed decision whether she needed Mr. Grapsis's help or not. She was relying on him to assist her, to let her know what she needed to do with respect to her daughter. And again, on that issue, Mr. Sullivan, the board's expert, testified that standard practice with immigration lawyers, when you know that, is to inquire about family status and make sure that there is a clear understanding concerning the immigration status of the minor children of the alien applicant. And in this situation, the referee's findings, I believe, are consistent with the testimony of Ms. Nassidi, who was saying, based upon my experience when I was in a student status, I didn't know that my daughter's dependency status wouldn't be automatically extended. So she was acting on the basis of ignorance. She was depending on Mr. Grapsis to advise her, and his failure came before a G-28 would have ever been signed because Ms. Nassidi didn't know that she needed help. That's the gist of the board's position on the failure to advise, and I believe that the referee's findings on this issue are supported by ample evidence such that they are not clearly erroneous. I want to turn then to the fifth and the sixth claims for discipline here, which involve violations of Supreme Court Rule 20:8.4 sub C, as the referee found that Mr. Grapsis made false and misleading statements of two kinds in this engagement, one of them consisting of the false and misleading statements to the client during this time frame when she was waiting, or she thought she was waiting for action on her LCA, and the other part of it being the alteration of the forms. With respect to the communications with the client, I think it follows from the referee's conclusions that the failure to file was the product of neglect. It necessarily follows from that that Mr. Grapsis has and has continued to make false and misleading statements in denying what was simple neglect in failing to timely file and initiate this green card application process. Now, that the referee's findings on this paragraphs 16 through 23 of the referee's report, in which she notes that Mr. Grapsis did not return many of the client's calls during this 15-month hiatus. And then when she did get through to him, the statements that he would make were to the effect it would take a long time to complete the process, he would check into it. He never said that he had not filed the application. And the referee found that the statements were made with the intent to lead the client to believe that the application had been filed and that Mr. Grapsis was simply waiting for government action. The balance of the referee's findings are set out in the subsequent paragraphs. I think that the basis for the referee's findings as to the false and misleading statements is buttressed by particularly what happened in February of 1995, immediately before the time Mr. Grapsis finally filed the LCA with Indiana. What happened on that weekend? Ms. Nassidi finally got through to Mr. Grapsis on a Friday night at his home. She spoke with him on the weekend. Again, she never was told that the application had not been filed. Suddenly, on Monday, after the weekend of Ms. Nassidi, I think literally harassing and haranguing Mr. Grapsis to find out what was going on with her application, suddenly the application is filed with Indiana Department of Workforce Development by Federal Express. By Federal Express. There was no time rush, but suddenly it's an overnight delivery, and conspicuously absent on the letter of transmittal is a carbon copy to his client. And then what does he advise his client after he files 15 months late? He sends her a fax, which again says nothing about the fact that there had been a 15-month delay in filing, but simply says he had talked to Indiana and expected to be getting a letter from them. Those are set forth. These documents are in the exhibits. The letter of transmittal is Exhibit 2. And the fax to Ms. Nassidi is Exhibit 4. The alteration of the dates, I would suggest, also supports the referee's findings that there were false and misleading statements to the client designed to prevent her from finding out that there had been a 15-month delay in filing her application. Why did Mr. Grapsis never call the client, the clients, to get their assent to altering the dates? Why didn't he send the document back to them to initial the alterations of the signature? Because he didn't want them to know that the application hadn't been filed. Those are the inferences that I believe support the referee's findings of fact on the issue of false and misleading statements. And again, there's more than ample evidence to support the referee's findings.
I don't quite get the connection there, counsel. I'm missing something. He changed the date from 1995 to 1996, correct?
That is correct.
Why would that be designed to hide from his client his failure to file the paper?
I think the inference...
I can understand if he backdated it, but...
I think the inference, Your Honor, is that he wanted, if he files in 1997 documents bearing signature dates of 1995, that's going to raise a red flag with the agency. And they're going to say, why are we looking at a 15-month-old application? And if it gets red flagged, it's going to get sent back.
Yeah, well, not only that, it's easier to change a 5 into a 6 and have it undetected than to change a 5 into a 7 and have it undetected. And I've just been looking at the record in that regard now. So I suspect that was the reason.
Well, and with respect to Mr. Grapsis's statements that the G-28 form somehow authorized him to update the application, as he calls it, first of all, these applications are signed under penalty of perjury. They're signed under penalty of perjury. And again, making the analogy to a notice of appearance, which is what a G-28 form is, in my years of practice, I have never heard it advanced by anyone that the fact that filing a notice of appearance authorizes me as an officer of the court to change dates on documents signed by my client under penalty of perjury without, at the very least, notifying the client and getting their assent, even assuming that it's not a violation of federal law to alter dates. But furthermore, on that issue, again, in Exhibit 6, the authorities at the Indiana Department of Workforce Development noted the alteration to the signature dates, and when they responded to the successor counsel who was on the file at that point, Indiana authorities noted any alteration must be initialed and dated by the person whose signature appears in the form. Now, Mr. Grapsis has said that somehow or other the G-28 form authorizes him to do this. He has cited no legal authority for that proposition whatsoever. And I don't think it flows by inference from the fact that a notice of appearance has been filed. I want to close, Your Honors, briefly with comments on the rationale for discipline in this case. This is the third disciplinary proceedings involving Mr. Grapsis. The board has asked for a 6-month suspension in this case, and we believe that a 6-month suspension is merited because of the seriousness of the allegations in this case as well as the prior discipline. I don't think I can explain the rationale for the discipline any better than the referee did in this case, and I would direct the court's attention to that section of the report dealing with this issue, paragraphs 2 through 6, where the referee outlines the specific rationale supporting the 90-day suspension, and in particular in paragraph 6, where the referee states, given the repetitive nature of the conduct, the potentially disastrous effect on vulnerable clients, coupled with the fact that neither education nor discipline is likely to alter behavior, this requires consideration of revocation of his license to practice law. The referee is the neutral arbiter appointed by this court. The neutral arbiter thought, I believe it's fair to say, that if anything, 6 months is the minimum suspension. A 6-month suspension will require Mr. Grapsis to come before this court and demonstrate his fitness to practice law, that he's fully complied with the sanction to be imposed in this case, and we believe the record supports that recommendation by the referee. The board, again, is requesting the imposition of a 6-month suspension along with an order requiring full restitution to Ms. Nassidi, and that Mr. Grapsis be ordered to pay the costs of this proceeding. Thank you, Your Honor.
I have one question.
Yes.
What is the upshot of all of this? Do you know what's happened to Ms. Nassidi and her daughter?
Ms. Nassidi was out of work for one semester due to the fact that the process was not completed on time. She had to leave her place where she lived that was supplied by the school. She found friends to move into and stayed with them during the fall semester of 1997. Her successor counsel did eventually successfully complete the process, and she is back with
what about the daughter?
School. The daughter was able to avoid deportation as well. The successor counsel was able to. I believe that there may be a penalty paid in connection with that, but they were able to avoid that harm.
Is there a reason why restitution isn't being requested for the money that she was not paid during that semester that she was out of work?
Your Honor, there was some thought given to that by myself, and I believe that that may be something that crosses the line into becoming a private malpractice action, because Mr. Sullivan, when I spoke with him, was unable to say, to make that causal link to a reasonable degree of probability.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Grasses.
Your Honors, first I'd like to, in rebuttal, bring to your attention that it's not the notice of appearance that gives the attorney any authority to act on behalf of a client. It is, as discussed in my main brief, starting at page 14, pursuant to the regulations and the case law of the Immigration Service discussed on those pages, that gives the authority for counsel to act on behalf of a client to make full authority to make concessions and admissions. This is not because merely a notice of appearance has been filed. Secondly, as far as the time that it takes for the 200 days are mentioned, again, this is discussed in my brief, that 200-day time limit that the expert witness noted is only, it's a backward report of the time it takes. In other words, as of that time, it took 200 days. If you had started 200 days earlier, it doesn't say what it would take from if you start on that date and go forward. As discussed in my brief, as the time went on, the time periods grew longer, up to 500 days. And in order to get it done, by the time 500 days came along, you had to start 500 days back in order to be at that point of 500 days. As far as representing her daughter, I, as an attorney, have no problem representing anybody if I'm advised that I should so represent that client. I was advised by Ms. Nassidi I would not represent any of her daughters, even the ones that were citizens, U.S. citizens, because they were having some problems in getting passports and documentation over at the U.S. consulate in the home country, that if she could not resolve these problems, she would let me know, and then I would represent her daughters, and then I would have them sign the G-28. That never happened until she had called me and said she forgot to extend the H-4 visa for her daughter, and at that point, I did send the G-28 for her daughter to sign it for her.
Counsel, if I recall, it is on an extension of that point that you have a concession of misconduct. Correct me if I'm wrong. That is, you earlier said that the board alleged misconduct and that it took 3 or 4 days for you to notify the mother of the denial of the daughter's application. Correct or incorrect?
No, that's true. I didn't notify her the day I got it. I faxed her a decision about 3 or 4 days later.
How does that comport, that concession, comport with the referee's findings that on May 1, 1997, finding number 33, that the INS denied the daughter's application and then sent the notice of denial to you, and that on June 3rd, 1997, a little more than a month later, the mother called you, and at that time you advised her that it had been denied?
Yes, I didn't receive that decision until near the end of May. And at the time she called me, then at that time I got her fax number and I sent it down. Faxed it over to her.
The inference from findings 33 and 34 to me are that on May 1, INS denied and sent you a notice, and then she called on June 3rd. Maybe it's a little more than 3 or 4 days, but that's your position.
No, I'm saying that the decision was dated May 1st, but I did not receive it on May 1st. I received it later in May. And then after I received it, Ms. Nassidi called me, gave me her fax number, and I faxed her a copy. Now, I submit that the failure to file her labor certification application was not because of any neglect. There are differences in strategies among attorneys, and I think this is one of those cases, and where the board claims that there was nothing to show that the government was doing anything to remedy this backlog situation. That's true. The government was not doing anything. It was the attorneys that were trying to make the government do something, either by legal action or by legislative action in the Congress.
If this was just a matter of strategy, counsel, why falsify the document and send it Federal Express after your client had harassed you over a weekend?
I did not falsify the document.
Yes,
I stated
you did.
The
you
document.
Changed the date, did you not?
I do not consider that falsifying the document.
Well, that falsified a date and made a false representation to the federal government about when that was signed. And you falsified it not in one place, but in three places, in the employer's signature, in the employee's signature, your client's, and on the notice of retention or notice of appearance form.
I did not falsify the document, Your Honor. What
it
I did was updated the document. I changed the date to make it a rather current document.
You made
it. I send most of my applications by FedEx. It's not an unusual situation.
You made it current by 11 months, but not current to the date of filing. So if it was your intention just to make it current as to the date of filing, why didn't you use the date of filing?
I just wanted to bring it right up to date instead of having an older document.
Well, no, except there was counsel. There was a difference in the date. You updated the date to November of 1996, and you filed it in February of 1997.
I understand. But that was around the time I thought I would file it.
So you made it only slightly less stale than it was.
Slight less what?
Stale, late, delayed, neglected.
No. Well, at one time I thought I would file it around the date that I had changed, but I didn't do it at that time.
So you're saying you falsified the date back in November, which is the date that the document bears because of your falsification of it, or you falsified it on the date that you filed it in February?
No, I didn't falsify that. I changed the date to bring the document to be more current in dates.
So you did that in February when you sent it Federal Express, not back in November, which is the
No,
date
I had done it. I had done it already, but I did not file it at that time when I did it. Again, it was not... It didn't appear to me there was anything appropriately done that would have changed the way the Department of Labor was operating. And that was the whole problem, and how to deal with this backlog.
And it remains your position that this does not constitute filing a falsely dated document with the federal government. subjecting your client and the employer to charges of perjury.
My position on that, Your Honor, is that I was acting pursuant to the full authority authorized by the regulations and the case law of immigration practice as discussed in pages 14 and 15 of my main brief.
And you argue with straight face to this court that authority authorizes you to falsify a date on a document that is submitted under pains and penalty of perjury. File a false document with the federal government.
I didn't falsify that. I changed the date. That's like making an admission, a concession.
That's like saying I changed the name from Smith to Jones. I didn't falsify Smith's name.
No, I didn't change anything. I didn't change, the names of it. I didn't alter the presentation of who I was representing or anything like that. I updated a document, which is not unusual.
Are there any further questions by the
I have one question. Mr. Grapps, why did you file for the Wisconsin clients and not for this Indiana client? If this was your strategy, this idea that if you delayed, they'd give you a break somehow and move your client to the front of the line.
My decision was I could see that no matter what I did, whether I filed or did not file, it would not change the outcome. So I wanted to see if I could do something else, because once you get into the track of filing, you can't get it out of it. I wanted to see if there was something else that would happen, some of all these efforts that were being made to have the government act in a responsible manner, if I could get it into that kind of a track instead of filing it back in time and have it backlogged. In a place where you couldn't get it out of there once it's in there. Once it's in there, it stays there until the government decides to move it. And that was the problem.
Chief, I have one further question, please. I've checked the record, and your response to BAFR didn't come in until the very end of October. I think it was October 25th or 28th, something like that, some 7 or 8 weeks after the second letter was received and the deadline imposed in the second letter from BAFR. You said earlier today to us that it was just a week or two later.
I didn't recall the dates. I know I responded. I don't recall the exact date. The dates are in the record, but I don't recall the exact dates when
I
responded.
Yes, but you represented to us just a few moments ago that it was a mere matter of a couple of weeks after you received the second letter, when in fact it was at least 7 or 8 weeks.
To the best of my recollection, Your Honor, I did respond within the time I thought I did. Now, the record will show exact dates when I did respond. What I'm saying is I responded. I did not not respond. I did not try to ignore the board.
Justice Prosser has a question for you, counsel.
Mr. Grapsis, you're still actively involved in practicing law?
Yes, I am, Your Honor.
In immigration?
Immigration and other areas, yes.
Approximately how many cases do you have pending?
Of all cases or?
Of immigration cases.
A couple hundred.
Thank you.
Counsel, thank you. That ends our argument for today. On November 11th, the court will sit in Janesville for the conclusion of the November oral argument. We are in recess until that day.